Blog Talk Radio.
Companion. I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. I'm glad that you're able to join us. We have an interesting talk going on today, I think, and a little bit of some of the best music I think we can assume is going to happen for this period of the year. For those of you who haven't been able to get out to Lodge, welcome. I hope that it is certainly in no way suggests that we can replace the experience of the Lodge. But if this enhances the discussion or your thinking in some small way, then we've served a purpose, and that's about as good as it gets. Tomorrow is the anniversary of something that happened so very, very long ago in 1320, Declaration of a Broth. I just want to mention it because it's part of my heritage, and it rings, it has some authenticity for anybody that might be familiar with the some of the original Constitution of the United States. You'll hear me talk about things in terms of the original because everything goes on, everything evolves, and what goes on there today is confusing for me, and I don't think I might be the only one in the world that's confused by that. But this was the declaration was quite simple. It's the form of letters written in Latin, and it was sent to Pope John the 22nd. This was remarkable because it sidestepped the king of the Scots, or who was sitting in there. On the throne at the time. This was dated the 6th of April, of course, and it was intended to confirm Scotland's status as an independent sovereign state, defending Scotland's right to use military action when unjustly attacked. We think it was written by Bernard of Kilwinning. He was the Chancellor of Scotland and the Abbot of Arbroath at the time, and it was sealed by, it's lovely, the Tyningham copy. Was sealed by 51 magnates and nobles. Very, very, interesting old piece, of course. It was a part of a broader diplomatic campaign. It was after asserting Scotland's position as an independent kingdom. And one of the things I think it captures is that they had a covenant between the people of Scotland and God. And the Pope recognized Edward I of England claim as over Scotland in 1305. And the Bruce was excommunicated by the Pope for murdering John Comyn at the altar of Greyfriars Church in Dumfries. That was just then the very next year. But the declaration made a number of rhetorical points. And that Scotland had always been independent longer than England, and that Edward I had unjustly attacked Scotland and perpetrated atrocities, and that Robert the Bruce had delivered the Scottish nation from its peril. In fact, it stated that the nobility would choose someone else to be king if Bruce proved to be unfit in maintaining Scotland's independence. Some have interpreted this last point as an early expression of popular sovereignty. You know, you're there, but we're going to make the call. We're going to make the decision. It had been argued that the declaration was not a statement of popular sovereignty, but a statement of royal propaganda supporting Bruce's faction. To this man, inasmuch as he saved our people, and for upholding our freedom, we are bound by right as much as by his merits, and choose to follow him in all that he does. So the longest, and you'll hear this, as long as only one, you'll remember this, of course. This is one of the most incredible, inspiring pieces. So I won't to take time out of our day to read it, but do make a point of, do yourself a favor if you want something, you want to see something that is inspiring. Do yourself a favor and dig into, take it off the library, your bookshelf, or use the internet. This has opened up the world to the rest of, the mind to the entire world and every bit of history. This is the 95th day of the year. There's only 270 days left. Kind of exciting. I can feel the tension just coming through the airwaves to me, waiting for in the northern hemisphere, the summer solstice is coming down the pipe, the 21st of June. So be there or be square, that starts the first day of summer, and we have that to look forward to. We now think that maybe Stonehenge, people are trying to reach back as much as they can and create the pageantry of Stonehenge. And there's some discussion now that the Stonehenge was the platform for a stage, which makes it a different kind, makes us think of it in much different terms. It's like the staging at Woodstock. It was high off the ground, and everybody had to look up at whoever was up there, and what were they doing up there? Those are all kinds of speculative questions, but interesting. And we'll when the sun emerges from the darkness, then we'll have the return of God, or the return of growth, the return of life as we know it on Earth, and according to those beliefs. I want to talk to you a bit about the term pagan. It's always interesting. This came about, it came about because there needed to be a line. At least the Christians wanted a clear line between them and us. So before that, there were just Christians. There were people that weren't Christians. The way we have to look at it is pre-Christian. They were what they were. But to galvanize the crew, because there were a lot of people going, and there were more than one Messiah at the time, people going around claiming to do miracles. So in order to pull this together and get things organized, they had to have a little bit of a plan. So part of that plan was the development of this term. It's how Hellene comes to mean pagan. Greek became associated with the traditional polytheistic beliefs of ancient Greece and was regarded as a foreign language. But by the latter half of the 4th century in the Greek-speaking East, pagans were paradoxically commonly called Hellenes or Greeks. The word most entirely ceased being used in a cultural sense. This was influenced by Christianity's early membership, who were Jewish. Jews at the time distinguished themselves from foreigners according to religion rather than ethnocultural standards, and early Jewish Christians would have done the same. Christianity inherited Jewish terminology for non-Jews and adapted to it to refer to non-Christians they were in contact with. And we see that recorded in the New Testament, especially the writings of Paul. Some pagans were defiantly calling themselves Hellenes. Other pagans preferred the narrow meaning of the word, a broad cultural sphere of a more specific religious grouping. So the growing religious stigmatization of Hellenism had a chilling effect on Hellenic culture by the late 4th century. So remember, the 4th and 5th century, we also saw the word of the prophet, peace be with him, being passed on to the world. And what are today considered significant and important religious practices had their roots two of them had their roots in this early period. Judaism comes from an earlier period, back with those so-called pagan rituals and cults and practices. Of course, if we strip away the religious ethno-cultural rhetoric, we find that people were practicing expressions of faith in a creator as far back as communities and culture and civilization can be traced. And probably in the minds of most of us, that wonder when we look up at the sky was there for the earliest man, the earliest woman, when they happened to look up and wonder about those dots of light in the sky, that great big hot orb that showed up on the horizon every day, before the period where we had things organized into what we call history. There was a period when the study of history and the organization of our thoughts into history didn't exist. And you think about what happened if you don't have a sense of history. What we have is a sense of again and again. Things happened again and again. The sun is there tomorrow. The sun is there yesterday. The sun is there day after. Again and again. A simpler way of thinking. Huh? Well, today I'm asking you to consider the brethren in the room, to consider this whole process of rediscovery and rethinking the craft. And think about, the lament. I want to try and move on from the lament. We haven't been able, I don't think, to do that from the writings that I see. This process of notice has been going on for quite some time. The process is about writers, very delicate thinkers, talking out there, writing out their thoughts about what was going on in Freemasonry that left them with a feeling that there was an accretion, that there had been some kind of watering down of the purity of the order. And this goes on to our very day, this very day. I would like to think that we have the capacity to move beyond that. Because if that is, we're simply talking about the laws of entropy, aren't we? That only in a phenomenological sense of the term, that eventually everything will spread apart, will reach this common flattening, this common point of tension And we'll all be, the great uniformity will occur throughout the universe. I'm not going to be around here in a billion years when Andromeda crashes into the Milky Way, but I'd like to be there just to see what that's going to be like. Of course, that'll be outside of memory because we won't know, and one man will be able to witness it. Just it happens so gradually. The things in masonry, I think, you know, I'm reaching here a bit, saying that the laws of entropy are affecting what's going on in masonry. That's a bit of a stretch, but I'm making an argument here. You know, cut me a little slack. the argument I'm making here, the point I'm making is that I don't dare define the order as having lost something, because I think what we know as the order or how we define the order has changed. But the essence, the intensity, the authenticity of Freemasonry has never been affected. And again, I think it's because the study of Freemasonry has become very pedestrian. We often hear, and I think this phenomena has more to do with the economic and political change in our communities. These things are very significant influences. The effect of wars. We're producing compliance. We want our children to have some degree of social grace in order to comply and fit in with the culture so that they can experience the very best of what the culture has to offer. So we want that for our children. But what happens when compliance interferes with the thought process, that independent thought process? Well, we need the radical. We need to take that into account. Even math, we look at the theory of chaos and theory of radicalism and this gives us some ideas about looking at the phenomena of Freemasonry from outside the orb, outside the sphere of the Masonic function. And I think it's quite interesting. Can I say to you that the essence is ethics, philosophy, and a sense of spirituality, if not spiritualism. The idea being that having an appreciation of these qualities, being able to explain or to articulate a personal philosophy are key ingredients in a man living a good life. Now, that predisposes us to think that reading and enriching the mind will help to enhance the personality, make us more in the eyes of the people around us. So this isn't the type of thinking for the smug and the arrogant. We can see that in the approach to this fraternal order. But what has happened, I think, is remarkable. I think the study, we have for a long time been suffering from the fact that Freemasonry was passed on a mouth to ear. No, that happened for a lot of reasons, and we, I think, would be guessing if we said that that was completely deliberate. But all of that aside, some of the exposés that happened in the 16th century, the 17th century, and the 18th century, have given us ideas, given us a sense of what was going on at the time. And our historians today, I have better equipment than they did 100 years ago. Everything's being redefined, But I think, well, let's put that one on the shelf, the idea of discovery of facts from before, because the facts were to a large extent, descriptions of dates and descriptions of lists of names of people who were in a particular place at a particular date. Now, nothing gives us a more dire sense of history than that. To strip away history to a date, the names of people in a room and the location, is to absolutely ignore the point. The point is, all of those ingredients don't get together for any historical reference or purpose. They get together because they're doing something. Something has brought those people together at a particular time. Whether we look at 1715, 1716, 1717 as a gathering in a pub in our terms, 21st century terms. Well, let's have a pint and let's slap each other on the back and have a good time. Well, there was something else in the minds of somebody in that room. I don't know if it was everybody in the room. We do know that it wasn't a large crowd. We do know that the event was advertised in the local press. So what's the secret? There was no organization. Nobody had an idea what we were talking about, did they? So we didn't have the protections. The way to protect yourself was to keep quiet. That's not changed to this very day. If you want to maintain your privacy, you have control over your mouth. Yeah, I'm sorry, but you do. Well, yeah, I know the paparazzi are following you around, hiding behind every shrub. And whenever you go scratch your arse, they're there to take a picture of it and put it on the front page of the local paper. But personally, I don't think anybody cares. Neither did they in the early 18th century, not with what was going on at the time. So we had just come through the trials of Galileo, didn't we? And the workings of Copernicus were out there. We still didn't have the development of Darwin. We didn't have that yet. But we look at what was going on in those dates. Not everybody was studying everything that there was about spirituality, but we think, what was the library? You want the answers to what was going on at the time. Look into the libraries of the gentry. Look into the libraries of people that were thinkers. It doesn't matter whether they were craftsmen or not, whether they were wealthy or not. Most likely, just like it is today, there's rank as privilege. That hasn't changed. We may not like it, but it's a valid and it's true. Rank as privilege. Now, if we're going to, we want to know what was on the mind, look at the books on a man's library. Look at whether they're there as props. Have the spines been cracked or opened? Has the book ever been, is it heavy worn and thumbed, or is it just like it was when it was brand new? That tells you, well, what was influential, because when you're reading through material and it captures your imagination, you refer to it repeatedly. Some of my best friends have material that's around them all the time because they go to it for reference. Now, without meeting these people, without meeting these men, and for goodness sakes, we need to get over this bloody chauvinism that it's the male brain that contributes to the world at large, or that it's white Anglo-Saxon or Norman that contributed. The dates, we've just stunned ourselves into indifference. We've taken something very dynamic and and bored ourselves. We've taken, sucked all the imagination and fun out of it, and we give lists. This is a picture of a dead old guy. This is a date. This is a location, and this is the other people in the room. Next, there's another picture of a dead old guy. So we have, even the history doesn't really tell us what was going on in the mind of the boy. Perhaps one of the things that is really striking about Albert Pike is that we know so much about his work. And that helps us to understand more about him. Do we want to know that somebody was a labor leader or a general? Not particularly. What we need to know today is that what kind of person, what shaped that person? What were the elements that we consider the greatness? Because if we're looking for things that are inspiring, we're not looking for the competitive. We're not looking for, unless we're on the sports field, but that's sports. You know, if we want to talk about the seriousness and the cultural importance of sports, that's a different discussion entirely. And that's where we want to see the competition played out purposefully. The boxers step into a ring, there's a competition, but it's an eye-to-eye. There is no disguise about what is going to happen. If you're looking for the ultimate in competition, some people might say playing poker, I suppose. I don't know. For me, it's the boxing match. And if you think back about Freemasonry in the day, we can look back and say, well, there's the period of Reformation, and you and I can study it. Do we? Well, reading about it doesn't necessarily mean we understand it a lick. We can look at the period of Enlightenment, and then we can look at the periods of major tragedy in Europe. Europe was fairly significant at the time, but not only. Is Masonry, the purity of the idea, universal, or is it culturally bound? Is it a white man's game, or is this something that is between the creator and every one of his creations? Because if it is, then we need to open up our minds to the history of the entire, of mankind, of humanity, all over the world. We need to be able to embrace what was going on in the Arab states, in the Middle East, in the Far East. That we're products of the ethnocentrism of the 18th, 19th, 20th century. We are. You know, it's like there are countries, get this, there are countries that will take ownership over an apple pie. I know, it gets ridiculous. Countries where people think that if they say they were first, then they were first. If they say they're better, then they're better. And now we have little nitwits going around making all kinds of nasty threats over to our brethren in Africa. And if any of those boys and girls over there are anything like the people around here, they're not going to be sitting back saying, oh, he's making threats. It's like, I'm going to do something very, very damaging to you for even making the threats. And I'm going to kick your ass for even thinking about them. You don't even have to say anything, let alone execute them. That's just what you ought to open up that Pandora's box. It ain't pretty, but nobody's going to be running around. And as a matter of fact, our friends and brethren to the south are, you can hear the click of all the guns loading, lock and load. You think you're going to present a threat by mouthing off? Well, where I saw that at its most perilous was when I was working in Detroit. Little kids with handguns. That's not so much the problem. It's frightened little kids with handguns that are being threatened. And don't you think a handgun being pointed at you ain't a leveler? Anyway, so we wake up out of this fool's paradise. Do we understand what was going on? Well, the only way we're going to do it, you know, is by taking on responsibility. It's you and I. It's not the order. It's nothing about the governance, the grand lodges. It's nothing. they do a superb job in their own way. This is like a very difficult process, and they do a superb job. They don't have a team of 1,000 because we wouldn't have it. So what do we give them? A small teams of people to run this huge organization. If we went out and said, right, let's find all the corporations that have this many people involved in it. What are we now? Let's say 50,000, 60,000, whatever it is. And match up. How many staff do you need to just handle the logistics on that? You know, well, do you think it's going to be enough to fit in a room? Well, we're the ones that are doing that. It's not they doing it to us. We're doing it to us. So if we want to share, discuss, and explore the ideas, if we think there is some merit in that, then it's up to us to do it. We have no business acting like sheep, because it's feek. We're not sheep. Every one of us is capable of reasoning. Isn't that the big part of Freemasonry, that we put aside superstition? Superstition is another polite way of talking about the days when we turn to our religious leaders for interpretation of science. And what they did wasn't dastardly. What the religious leaders of the time did was make interpretations consistent with scripture, consistent with religious history. They were being consistent. I have no business mocking them. But today, the questions that we're asking are pushing that envelope way out there. So if we're looking at the it's not the rebuilding of Freemasonry, it's the rediscovery. It's always been there. Always been there. And it doesn't mean that this is pointing a finger at you. Where does that immediate sense of blame come from? The ideas of Freemasonry don't come packaged with this sense of guilt and blame. That's hardly what motivates a grown and mature man. It's something deeper, a gnawing appetite, a hunger for knowledge. And those men do exist. And they have influence. But what we don't do is talk about that influence, because we're still caught up in the old rhetoric. I swear sometimes I think some boys think that this is a personality cult, because we have to talk about a person and associate his name with his behavior, his accomplishments, as if the accomplishments of dead old guys is going to inspire Canada of the 21st century. Well, let me whisper in your ear very privately, gentlemen, that ship has sailed. I'm going to let you listen to a little bit of music for a second. I'll be right back. Thank you. small Italian woman, Maria Callas. O mio bambino caro, Giacomo Puccini. How do we convey that sense of passage of time? Well, Masonry asks us to look for the best. Well, I don't know what the, always know what the best is. So I look at, for things that are enduring, the music. Some folk music is enduring. Some opera moves audiences every time it's performed. Some plays. Why does Shakespeare continue to be one of the most popular playwrights in the history of mankind? Is it because it's for the elite? Is it because you dress up and it's sort of, you can be smug about listening to, going to Shakespeare, to a play? Or is it because there's something enduring in the way that, in what he wrote and how the performers and are able to capture a mood that still resonates with audiences? The tragedy of Madame Butterfly, the sense of a portrayal. I don't know. I'm not here to say that it's just a matter of taste. It's like either you get it or you don't. I guess it's like, you know, do you want to develop your palate to, so you can discriminate between one wine and another? Or do you just want to guzzle it all down like it's plunk? Well, or do you just want to chug a lug? Or do you want to be able to understand the differences of a whiskey or a vodka or a tequila? Do you want to... Or fine food. What makes the food so amazing? Well, it's the company and it's the atmosphere. It's the effort, the concern that's put into it, you know. But in the merits of the meal, there's so much. But it's not like eating the same meal over and over and over again. It's that willingness to explore. So when I'm in Belgium, I want to taste what the Belgians like. When I'm in Japan, I want to taste that. Or if I'm in Egypt, I want to taste the cuisine. So pull back. Pull back. It's a fool's, it's a mug's game, as they would say. We don't... It's a mug's game to continue to observe this. It's like you're telling me, oh, a car passed me today on the road. Oh, another car passed me. Well, I got it. We got it. There's something going on. You're sitting there and something's passing you by. Well, brethren, what are you doing about it? You're sitting there and you're complaining and you're not doing anything about it. Oh, the flash here is that complaining ain't doing anything. So be polite, keep quiet, unless you've got something to offer. And don't be sitting down talking about giving directions to everybody. If everybody thought the same, everybody thought like me or thought like you, the world would be a better place. Oh, horror of horrors. This is where we dust it off, admit to ourselves that there's questions, we have questions, and go and find the answers for those questions. Who am I? Why am I here? Do you need the big ones? Are the basic ones the big ones for you? Or do you need it to phrased in elaborate vague language. Maybe our friends, the physicists and mathematicians, will teach us and tell us, when they ask a question, how they go about finding the answer. Purity of thought. The precision. They rely on the precision. Masonry has all of the it's based on ethics, was it? Well, the men that talk frankly and candidly and reliably about the order seem to be ethical creatures. They simply don't appear to be self-serving. The people that seem most comfortable in their own skin, the Masons that seem most comfortable in their own skin, are Masons that have come to some understandings. They've done that because they've read material, and within their own mind, there are things that they believe to be true or valid. Let's say valid, because truth, remember we've talked about opinion and truth. So let's say that we're searching out validity, and over the course of a life, we'll find out if our truths are truths. Or are we just deluding ourselves? Everything's excellent, everything's wonderful. Well, I don't know what that's about. Praising effort as excellent when it's to be expected. Oh, the look of horror on the faces of Masons when, you know, I should be offering that kind of praise, but it's like, man, that's what I expect. That's what's expected of us. Show up and make, you know, oh, here I am. I'm all dressed and I'm looking pretty. But, oh, don't ask me to do anything, you know. I don't want to get my hands dirty with all those tools. Then it might show that I don't really know what I'm doing and I might have to ask for help. There's some interesting truths. So the phenomena isn't to wait for everybody else to get off their high horse and start to do this, or their low horse, or to work themselves out of that point of confusion. The way that we've been taught for so long is to take leadership of control of your own life. At the end of the day, you have nobody to blame but yourself. What you make of yourself is up to you. You can complain that you weren't born a prince, or that you weren't born to wealth, or that you weren't born the particular color of the day, or your hair was curly, or your hair was straight, or you don't have hair. But at the end of the day, you're the one that's accountable for your life. Masonry talks about helping to improve. Improve what? Well, just to prove. Here's a little, I don't know whether you call it a pearl or a suppository. Depends on how I'm doing here with you today. Whether you can't get out to lodge or you enjoy this type of discussion your lodge doesn't offer, welcome to Masonic Home Companion. Here is a brain worm. If we are based on great ideas, and if we haven't studied those ideas, how then can we pass on that knowledge to somebody knocking at the door? As time has passed, we have been left with the stories and pictures of achievement. They're all around. That man was a mayor, that one was a lawyer, that one was a doctor, that was an architect, that was an artificer, that was a soldier. For generations, we have expected those stories are enough to replace the knowledge that inspired greatness. As if meeting in a hospital makes us doctors, as if visiting a gallery dressed like an artist with routine rituals would make us artists. If I buy golf clubs, I'm a golfer, but not Arnold Palmer. If I buy a boat, I'm a boater, but not Joshua Slocum. Doesn't the transformation process of Freemasonry have more qualifiers than that? Ideas can be neglected, but they do not die. Such possibility, if we think of it. possibility has been around us all the time. If you give it a second, it's always been there. Always. Confucian, you know, when China was trying to define the culture, they needed icons and Confucius, the sayings of Confucius, that respect for the elders. Well, you know, if your growth is to build cemeteries, you're not probably going to be building empires, are you? So our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time. You have to learn the rules of the game, and then you have to play better than anyone else. Failure will never overtake me if my determination to succeed is strong enough. Walt Disney said it, if you can dream it, you can do it. He didn't say that because he was a Mason. He happened to be a Mason who said that. We've sort of flipped the... run through to the other side of the mirror. We're saying, well, the people are brilliant because they're Masons. Excuse me. C.S. Lewis said, you're never too old to set another goal or to dream a new dream. And to what would be, if I was doing a motto, because, you know, we have a wonderful motto here in Grand Lodge of Canada. Aude vide tace. I think that Latin, so that it's understood around the world. There, you know, if you want to know why is it in Latin, it's because it's a common language. In order to succeed, we must first believe that we can. Start where you are, use what you have, do what you can. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better. Do you really want to know who you are? Then don't ask, act. Action. Your behavior will delineate and define who you are. It's within our grasp is what I'm getting at here. So we have fallen into boredom. It's not that the boys going in and out of meetings are less capable today than they were when they were younger or 5 years ago, or that the peacocks that are fluttering around the edges of lodges are going to stop coming around. They were always there, and they always will be. They don't really do much, but better to have a butt in the seat. So you tolerate the peacocks, and then you look at who is going to leave a mark. And that's the study. Mark Twain, you know. The secret to getting ahead is getting started. So we collectively and quietly agree here today to get started without bringing attention, without talking about it, to find, maybe I'm talking to them, singing to the choir here. You've probably already found it. It's what compels you to get to a computer, use the internet, and find me, and then listen. It's much appreciated. Don't think that I'm not part of this conversation, this ongoing thread that's been there for hundreds of years, from the time that Masonry started in Scotland, Masonry as we know it, to the time when, by the way, Elias Ashmole wasn't the first Mason. That was a Scottish fellow, another Scottish fellow. Elias was important, but, you know, if you're thinking about firsts, he wasn't the first, so don't be going around saying, and really, It's like our friend, Jean Doyer. It's talking about people as they are. What's more important, to talk about the people or to talk about his thoughts and ideas? What has he contributed? So I'm using a different, you know, in the lodge in the 15th century, when we were building a castle, the lodge room was a place of geometry. There weren't the instruments were simple, a pencil or something to scribe with, a straight line, a level, a square, something to measure and lay out angles. So the castles were built twice. They were drafted. The parts were then built from templates, and then it was dismantled and rebuilt in its proper place. Look, we do live a better life, I think, if we have answers to questions. We're better off if we are serious-minded about seeking answers to understand what's going on around us. That's not to say that this man is better than another man. That's not to say that, in a sense, the thinker is better than the plotter. But what is important is the contribution each of these fellows makes. They don't own it. They contribute, just like you and I, to the growing body of knowledge. Maybe they're there to try some of the ideas to prove that over the course of time, they're still valid. The scientific method. You have to be able to duplicate an event. Epicureanism goes like this. Atoms are a composite entity. There you go. Stoicism says spiritual, fiery part of the divine. Maybe you follow you become one of the people that are trying to be a Stoic for a month. Go online and look at that. Become topical around New York City. Be a Stoic. Learn what it is. It's like saying to yourself, I'm not going to invest energy or emotion in things that I can't change, the things that don't make any difference. See, it's a relatively simple, natural way of living. It's like those themes, not done rudely, like it sucks to be you. I always think that's bad manners, but it's more like we need to get over ourselves. That oftentimes we take offense of something that is meaningless in the big scheme of things, that will pass within minutes if we allow it. But it gives us that sense of righteousness that we can walk around feeling quite indignant. That indignancy and a nickel won't get you very far. I'm having a good time here today, but it is Easter. It is Easter. I think I should go out and enjoy some of that with my family. It's one of the highest, if not the highest, holidays of the Christian church. Yeah. It's also called Pesach or Pascha. It's a Resurrection Sunday. It's a festival and holiday celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I really thought when I looked into Christianity that it pulled together a lot of, it really did. It was built on a lot of ideas of faith and worship that had gone on for hundreds and thousands of years previously. And so the newness was that it worked, took all these ideas together and bundled them into something really, really interesting. So Easter is linked to the Jewish Passover by much of its symbolisms. The Christ was a Jew. A lot of people don't seem to pay much attention to this. So we look at the calculation of Easter moving all over the place. One of the lovely things about it is it's a lunar calculation. It's a movable feast. And it follows the only cycle of the sun. It's one of the few in the Georgian and Julian calendars. Its date's determined by the lunar calendar. So it has to be the first Sunday after the full moon that occurs on or soonest after the 21st of March. The first Sunday after the full moon that occurs on or soonest after the 21st of March. Here you go. So that's why it moves, because the cycle of the moon is 28 days and our months are, 30, 31, 28? I hope you do well this week. I hope you will think about this. I hope this kind of conversation has been useful to you. I hope so. If you can get out to Lodge, please pass on my greetings to one and all. It's always a pleasure to be in the company of good-minded Masons, healthy Masons, active Masons, Masons that are there to make a difference. I think we're achieving what we set out to do. Nobody ever said, not to be unkind, but nobody ever said the ideas of Masonry should fall into our lap, but it would help. It would help if we could deepen the study instead of making it unnecessarily, I don't think there's a point, pointlessly difficult, obscure. No reason to hide it. You know, we're paying a price for hiding the knowledge. And even to the point where it's going to take us decades, maybe, to get over the smugness, the complaints about what we call Masonic education, its ideas. If you try to talk about an idea in a Masonic lodge, it's added on to the end, and you know it. It's added on when everybody's looking at their watch, heading for the exit. They don't get it. You ever have the feeling you've been through, sitting through a remarkable performance? A remarkable performance. Just staggering. Very emotional, very intense. Very memorable. And there will be a portion of the audience that will head for the exits before the thing is done. No applause, no thank you, no courtesies to the performers. Just get out. Because we don't want to waste our time. Same thing happens. This is where we can make a difference. Don't have to sit there while people are tapping their foot looking at their watch. That's just impolite. Let them head to the door, but make a point of continuing the discussion at another time when it's convenient for one and all. And make sure that discussion is lively and well-informed. I have a little bit of music for you. Nothing quite as beautiful as Maria Callas' O Mio. But I do have some interesting pieces here that I think are great for this time of year. Be careful. Watch out for each other. Commit acts of random Masonic kindness. And I'll see you again soon. Thank you.
Ah, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. 3 centuries thereafter, I take passage overland in the footsteps of brave Kelso, where his sea of flowers began, watching cities rise before me, then behind me sink again. This tardiest explorer, driving hard across the plain, for just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea.
Bye for now. Enjoy your Easter.